Good afternoon. This is Pat Moore. I'll be your guest host today for Juno Afternoon. I'll be talking with the organizers of the upcoming sale auction. Paul Carroll will be in to give us a preview of the talk he'll be doing Thursday on U.S. nuclear policy. We'll get a little insight into the Low Vision Support Group with guests Cheryl Putnam and Daryl Weigand, and we'll learn about the Juno Community Charter School's upcoming trip to Denali and Fairbanks. We'll have that, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more today on Juno Afternoon. Weather for the Juneau area, rain will be increasing this afternoon with highs around 54. We'll have light winds becoming southeast 10 miles per hour late in the afternoon. Tonight, look for showers, low around 43, southwest winds, southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An act of civil disobedience is how a protest in Ottawa against the proposed Keystone XL pipeline was described. Environmental activists, labor union members, and First Nations people demonstrated in front of the Canadian Parliament. They were showing their opposition to the proposed pipeline. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
In all, there were about 400 protesters. After an hour of speeches, more than 100 of them organized themselves into small groups and carefully climbed over a police barricade. They then sat down in straight rows, waiting to be arrested. They were handcuffed, held for about 2 hours, and then fined $65 for trespassing. They were also told to stay away from Parliament Hill for a year. It was a peaceful but serious demonstration that many hoped would send a message to Canadian lawmakers to stop the pipeline. The protest was organized by Greenpeace and included environmental activists, labor union members, and First Nations people. Some of them, like Bill Erasmus, the national chief of the Dene, traveled hundreds of miles from Alberta to join the demonstration.
There are tailings ponds that total 700 square miles. That waste goes into the water system. We are downstream. We feel it.
The multi-billion-dollar Keystone XL pipeline would carry oil from Alberta to the Texas Gulf Coast. The Canadian government has already approved its part in the pipeline, but the protesters want Ottawa to reopen the issue. They say pipelines pose environmental risks, and this one would encourage development of the Alberta oil sands, considered by many as the dirtiest oil in the world. Canadian politicians were taking note. Even before the protest began, Prime Minister Stephen Harper was pushing back, saying the pipeline and the oil sands were a benefit to the Canadian economy. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Five Nevada tribes have been awarded federal grants of nearly $4 million to enhance law enforcement efforts. The Washoe Tribe of Nevada in California was one of them, as Willie Albright reports from Reno, Nevada.
U.S. Attorney Daniel Bogden says the money will fund community policing, anti-methamphetamine enforcement, and alcohol and substance abuse programs. It will also target violence against women, elder abuse, and juvenile justice programs. The grants are part of more than $118 million going out to nearly 150 tribes nationwide. Bogden says the Department of Justice grants show a substantial increase in funding despite the difficult economy. Included among the five Nevada tribes are the Fallon Paiute Shoshone tribe and the Washoe tribe in western Nevada. The Washoe tribe got more than $800,000 despite fierce competition from other tribes. Washoe chairwoman Wanda Batchelor credits the tribe's success to a team effort.
Having my Washoe tribal team, 12 different departments collaborating and working together with a clear vision of providing these vital services to our people is a win-win.
The other successful applicants are the Intertribal Council of Nevada, the Shoshone Paiute Tribes of Duck Valley, and the Timok Western Shoshone Tribe. For National Native News, I'm Willie Albright in Reno, Nevada.
A Native American television channel launches in California. FNX, a new multimedia platform featuring stories of indigenous people worldwide, went on air this week. The high-definition channel was created through a partnership between the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians and public broadcasting station KVCR in San Bernardino. Its creators say FNX is the first of its kind in the U.S. with the intentions to accurately educate the public about Native Americans. Southern California is the second largest television market in the United States. On this day in 1917, the Kokopa Indian Reservation was established by executive order. More than 1,000 acres were set aside for the reservation south of Yuma, Arizona. According to the Kokopa Indian tribe, today the reservation is more than 6,000 acres. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you could get a payment of up to $50,000 or more. There will be meetings in locations around the country between July and December 2011 where you can get free legal help filing a claim. More details and a full schedule of meetings is available at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3, and you're in tune with KTOO FM in Juneau. This is Pat Moore. I'm the guest host for today's Juneau Afternoon. My first two guests today are two lovely ladies, Jordan Nigro and Kate Walter, who are here from SAIL. And you're here to tell us about an auction, but before we go to that, I'd like to know what SAIL stands for.
SAIL stands for Southeast Alaska Independent Living.
Independent Living.
Yes.
And so who is living independently?
So the mission of SAIL is to inspire personal independence, and we are a center for independent living, and there are independent living centers all over the country. So what we do is work with folks of any age or any disability. We work with seniors and then people with disabilities of any age. And our goal is to help them to be more independent. So that might look different for different people. For some folks, that's helping transition out of a nursing home so they can live, you know, more independently in that manner. For other people, it may be helping them to get funds to get a wheelchair or even, you know, a walker, or it goes on and on. So one of our programs is Outdoor Recreation and Community Access, or ORCA. And ORCA is all about helping people to access recreation in the community to better their quality of life.
Jordan, what's your position with SAIL?
My position is deputy director.
Okay. And Kate, you are the...
I'm the director for the Outdoor Recreation Program.
Oh, so you run, you're the person in charge of ORCA?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what kinds of activities do you get involved with?
Well, gosh, I mean, year-round, we have year-round activities, so it depends on the season. In summertime, we're hiking and biking. Kayaking is pretty popular in the summertime. And we continue the hiking and the outdoor activities as far into the fall as we can without it getting too rainy. And then in the wintertime, we have an adaptive ski program up at Eagle Crest, and we're up there every single weekend from January till the last weekend of the season, usually.
When you say adaptive skiing, what does that mean?
So we have adaptive skiing for some might just be a one-on-one safety buddy to go ski independently on the mountain with them. Others, we have specialized equipment so we can get people who maybe use wheelchairs in their everyday life up onto our adaptive bi-ski and just, you know, going down the mountain. And so it looks different for every person, but it's a lot of fun, and we really think that we can meet everyone's abilities.
How did you train to become a person who can run all of these different kinds of programs for people?
Well, you know, I worked at a camp in Maine that had an Easter Seals component, and I realized I really enjoyed working with youth with disabilities in the outdoor setting, so I actually went to school for recreation management. So
where?
University of New Hampshire.
You can get a degree in
recreation management and policy.
that specializes in adaptive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, therapeutic recreation.
Hmm. Wonderful. Jordan, we're here to talk about an upcoming auction, which must mean that SAIL is probably not independently wealthy. What's your funding source?
We are primarily funded through grants. We have grants through the federal government, state government, and as well as community. Local grants from CBJ. So then a large portion of our funding is also through fundraising, and the dinner and auction that we have going on the 7th, next Friday night, is one of those events.
So this is Friday, October 7th.
Yep.
Where is
Friday,
it going to be?
Friday, October 7th at Centennial Hall from 6 to 9 p.m. So doors open at 6 and dinner served usually around 7 o'clock. So there's lots of time for bidding and visiting, and we always have such an amazing turnout of gifts and things that the community gives us from their businesses and personal folks, so that we can have a really great silent auction. We have trips all over Southeast Alaska. We have artwork. We have jewelry. We have, Kate, help me out here. We have lots of, desserts. We do a dessert auction.
Yes, we do a dessert auction.
That is always a big, popular thing. We always try to have some good stuff for the guys, because we always hear men need more things at auction. So we have some auto, some of the local auto stores help donate things and stuff like that. It's always very humbling at sale for us to see how well supported we are in the community, and so many folks give us things that we can auction off, and then so many folks come and support the auction and the dinner and sale and what we do. So this year the dinner is going to be catered by the Baranoff, and it's a really great menu, and we're excited about it.
What's on the really great menu?
The really great menu, let's see, I think it's roasted chicken and ratatouille and a fresh green salad, and then also a portobello mushroom option for vegetarians. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it should be good. And then on our program this year, we have the silent auction and the dinner, and then we also usually bring a speaker, or we have local speakers, kind of depending on the year. We sort of switch back and forth. And this year we are having a premiere of a short film that is about sale that Hannah Guggenheim from Sitka made. And Hannah is going to be coming over for the event and, kind of sharing what it was like to make the film. And it's in its finished version will be about 5 minutes, I believe, and this will be the first cut of it. So it might be a little shorter than 5 minutes. It won't be the completed piece, but everybody should get a good idea of what sale does, and it's, we are Southeast wide, and sometimes in Juneau you only see what we do in Juneau, but the video will show what we do Southeast wide. So we're excited about that. We will also be giving away an Advocate of the Year award for disability issues. So we've got that going on, and it should be a really fun night. We're looking forward to it. It's always, putting fundraisers together is always so busy and hectic, but we all always have a great time the night of.
I think the people who come do as well.
Yeah.
I've heard that it's one of the most fun fundraisers.
Yeah, people are always happy, so that's good.
So how much does it cost?
Tickets are $40, and you can get them at the sale office, which is at 3225 Hospital Drive, or this year, we have finally joined the world of getting tickets online. So you can also purchase tickets online at saleinc.org.
Okay. Are all of the things that you're auctioning off all decided, or are you still looking for any kinds of donations?
Well, we're certainly, if people have items they'd like to donate to the auction, we always have room. And for the silent auction, of course, there's always room for any item that someone would like to donate. But also the dessert auction, that's a big one, because we don't have dessert as part of our dinner. The deal is you have to bid on a dessert and share it with your table. And right now I think I have 14 confirmed desserts. But usually we need about 30 to have enough for everyone to bid on. I always enter a couple myself. It's my own challenge. I try to outbid what I made last year. So it's kind of a fun event if you like to bake, to give to a good cause, but really have fun at the same time.
So if someone did want to donate a dessert, who would they get in touch with?
They can just give me a call at the sale office, which is 586-4920. And I will get them all the information they need, and I can either pick the dessert up on Friday, or people are also able to drop them off at Centennial Hall starting at 5 o'clock.
And the phone number is probably on your website as well?
Yes.
So if somebody just Googled Sale Juneau or something like that, or Sale Inc. Juneau, they'd probably get to you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very nice. So the event, again, is Friday night at 7 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
I'm sorry.
Yep. Friday night, 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. The silent auction starts then.
Mm-hmm.
Is the dessert auction an outcry auction, or is it silent?
We save usually three or four of the desserts for the outcry, the fancier desserts that come in, we'll set aside for an outcry dessert auction. But otherwise, it's a silent bid as well.
Okay, and there's a five-minute or some part of the five-minute film that's being made in Sitka, and the producer is going to be there to talk about the
yeah,
piece.
Yeah,
she
flew all over to each of our offices and filmed in each place. So she's doing the putting it together in Sitka. She's from Sitka, but she came here and Ketchikan and Haines and Sitka to do filming. So
Baranoff's doing the dinner, and it's $40 a plate.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone wanted a group table, can they do that?
They can. We are selling tables. We can seat 8 to 10 people at a table, and tables are $400. Mm-hmm. And we will, you know, we have a lot of businesses that sponsor tables, or sometimes folks just want to get them for a group of their friends. And so we'll put a little sign, you know, for your business on the table, and or you can name your table something fun that we'll put on the table for you.
And I'm assuming for that you have to contact the sale office.
You can actually do that online, too.
Oh,
so
okay.
Either way, you can either come by the sale office and do it that way, or you can do it online at saleinc.org.
Wonderful. Sounds like a great event.
Yeah,
thank
we're
you very
excited.
Much
for
thank
coming you
down
very
and
much.
Us.
Well, thanks for having us.
Wonderful.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 27th of September, 2011. It was on this day, 1905, the German physics journal Annals of Physics published a paper by Albert Einstein, Does the Inertia of a Body Depend Upon Its Energy Content?, which produced the most famous equation in all of physics, E equals mc squared. It was one of four papers that Einstein published that year, a miraculous year for both Einstein and for physics. He was 26 years old. He'd published a paper in March of that year on the photoelectric effect, showing that light, which had been thought to always travel in continuous waves, can only be absorbed or emitted by an object in discrete packets. 2 months later came a paper on Brownian motion, how it is that small particles suspended in stationary liquid can still be seen to move continuously and in random fashion without any forces acting on them. In June came his paper on the special theory of relativity, and then on September 27th, in three short pages, Einstein made matter and energy equivalent when he derived equations that show if a body gives off energy, its mass diminishes by the ratio of that energy to the speed of light. And after that article came out, he went to his bed for 2 weeks, exhausted and with indescribable joy. And it was on this day in 1822, a brilliant young French scholar, Jean-François Champollion, announced to the French Academy that he had unlocked the key to translating ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. Using a block of stone that had been found by the French in Egypt some 20 years before, a stone covered with inscriptions, which we know as the Rosetta Stone, ancient Greek at the bottom, an unrecognizable script in the middle, and a band of hieroglyphs at the top. Here's a poem for today by William Matthews, entitled Promiscuous. Mixes easily, dictionaries used to say, a straight shot from the Latin. Chemists applied the term to matter's amiability. But the Random House Dictionary, 1980, gives as its prime meaning characterized by frequent and indiscriminate changes of one's sexual partners. Sounds like a long way to say slut, that glob of blame we once threw equally at men and women, all who slurred, slobbered, slobbered, slumped, slept, or lapsed, slunk or relapsed, slackened, loose-lipped, sank ships, or slubbed or slovened. But soon a slut was female. A much-bedded male got called a ladies' man. He never slept with sluts. How sluts got to be sluts is thus a mystery, except the language knows what we may have forgot. Depression began its career in English in 1656, says the OED, and meant, science jargon, the opposite of elevation, a hole or a rut, perhaps, or later, the angular distance of a celestial object below the horizon. as Webster's Third, 1963, has it. There's ample record of our self-deceit. Language, that furious river, carries on its foamed and sinewed back all we thought we'd shucked off. Of course, it's all pell-mell, head over heels, snickers and grief, love notes and libel, fire and ice, in short, promiscuous. A poem entitled Promiscuous by William Matthews from Search Party, collected poems published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzer. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 20 minutes after 3 in the afternoon. This is Pat Moore. I'm guest hosting today on Juno Afternoon. My next two guests, one in the studio with me here and one by telephone from, I believe, Sitka, are two gentlemen who are organizing a wonderfully interesting program called Nuclear Bombs, the Budget and You, and Budgets and You. And my guests are K.J. Metcalf and Paul Carroll. Hi, K.J.
Hi, Pat.
And hello, can you hear me, Paul?
I sure can, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon by phone from, are you in Sitka?
I am. I'm at the Sitka High School near their beautiful new Performing Arts Center.
Oh, what's your weather like down there?
I hear it's good for this time of year. I can actually see the sun.
Well, yes, we briefly saw it here in Juneau as well. It's quite an entertaining treat at this time of year. Well, I wanted to ask, I tend to think that government is who is in charge of nuclear bombs, and you've organized this event, which is on Thursday from 7 to 8:30 at the Juno Arts and Humanities JACC here in town. Why should I, as a private citizen, come to a talk or try to learn about our nuclear weapons policy?
Well, this is Paul. I would say that you're right. Okay, government, those in charge of nuclear weapons is us. I mean, we are the citizenry, and the last time I checked, our government was a constitutional democracy. Now, it may not feel that way to many of your listeners, because throughout most of the history of the nuclear weapons age, things were extremely secretive and almost mystical. But in the last decade or so, we, the people, have come to learn a lot more about the nuclear weapons enterprise and also about the limits of it. So I think that is reason why people should be interested in this topic.
Now, in particular, some of the advanced publicity for your talk talked about the fact that there's been a change in the nuclear weapons treaty. Is it the START treaty that requires us to expend some $700 billion over a period of time to develop new weapons? Is that the case?
It's not completely accurate. There was a political deal struck. The new START treaty, which was signed with Russia last year and then ratified by the U.S. Senate in December, was a modest step in terms of drawing down our arsenals, but it's a step forward. What happened was there was a political horse trade made by some conservative Republicans in the Senate that said, look, administration, we want to make sure that our weapons remain the best, even if we have fewer of them. And to make sure that happens, you have to promise us you're going to spend more money on the national labs and on the remaining nuclear weapons facilities that we have. And sort of with a wink and a nod, that deal was agreed to. Now, there's nothing in the treaty that requires the U.S. to spend that money, and frankly, there's nothing wrong with our arsenal or our delivery systems that that requires we do so. And now we're under incredible budget pressures. So, you know, you and I didn't make that deal. The administration did. And we have the right to rescind it.
Now, I don't want to steal the thunder from your talk Thursday night, but are you advising that there's action that that private individuals should take in response to this?
Well, let me answer
Go
that.
Go ahead, KJ.
we have Paul who's going to kind of give us the overview, and then we have hopefully a number of folks there. Beth Kertula will be there, as will Mayor Bruce Botello, and we're looking to get a discussion going among the folks in Juneau. As this seems to me to be an incredibly important issue for people in Alaska. And so we think that we can get a discussion going, perhaps a resolution in the state legislature that would recommend less money for nukes and more money for programs. We also, as Alaskans, carry our own nuclear legacy. Amchitka Island had three massive explosions, some of the largest explosions the U.S. set off. And that's a very fragile island, and it's kind of coming apart. And there's great caverns under it because of the nuclear explosions, and there's a real risk that that might leak. And so we think we need additional monitoring. I don't know if there's anything we can do if it starts leaking, but monitoring would be a good idea.
Now, when you say Amchitka has caverns underneath it, these were underwater or buried explosions that hollowed out a cavern?
That's right.
Okay, and now there's the chance that it could be leaking.
Yeah, that's correct.
And what evidence do we have of that?
Well, there recently have been some monitoring, but for many years there was virtually no monitoring.
At least they didn't. That same group of people, I think, were going to try to blow a harbor out of northern Alaska.
Well, right, Operation Chariot, I think. Thank goodness that didn't happen.
Yes, thank goodness that did not. Paul, when you come up to talk and to try to engender this discussion, what kinds of input are you hoping will happen after you've given your talk?
Well, I think the main challenge is to remind people that we still have these things with us. Most Americans, almost regardless of age, have forgotten about nuclear weapons. And while the risk has certainly diminished in many regards, we still live with approximately 20,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, most of which are owned by the U.S. and by Russia. So we bear a special responsibility to match that risk and ultimately to eliminate it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, as KJ was describing, you know, Alaska has a voice in this. This is about, yes, it is about national security, but it's also about global security, and it's also about fiscal responsibility and wisdom. And Alaska has two senators that occupy committees that are quite relevant to this, Senator Murkowski on the Senate Appropriations Committee and Senator Begich on the Armed Services Committee. So Alaska, you know, while its population is not huge, sort of fights above its weight class when it comes to its two senators that could have a voice on this issue.
I wanted to ask, KJ, how did you connect up with Paul? How did this opportunity for us come about?
Well, when I saw that we were going to spend such huge amounts of money on upgrading our nuclear arsenal, and I go back a long way with nuclear weapons, back to the 1956 when I was in the Army in Europe, and we almost went to war with Hungary over Hungary's revolt. And it came very close to a nuclear exchange. A lot of folks don't know that. And so I was there, and I looked around, and I thought there has to be a different way to solve problems. So nuclear weapons have been something that I wish we didn't have, and I've done whatever I can to see that at least we have fewer of them. So I started shopping around, and Paul, with the Plowshares Fund, was available, and we put together the trip, and he was able to stop in Sitka as well as here. So we're very pleased to have him, and I think it's going to be a great program, and I urge local folks to turn out. So that be Thursday, 7 o'clock to about 8:30, and it'll be a real community discussion.
And, again, it's at the Jack.
Right.
And there's no charge?
No charge.
Okay, so people can join you at 7 o'clock at the Jack on Thursday, September 29th. Very briefly, in the last seconds that I have left here, can you tell us what the Plowshares Fund is, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. We are a public foundation. So unlike foundations others may have heard of, like MacArthur or Ford, we raise money from individuals, and then we pool those resources and make grants to organizations that share our mission of reducing nuclear risks and reducing nuclear weapons. We're based in both San Francisco and Washington, D.C., so we both do grant making and direct activities ourselves in the Capitol and in the executive branch.
Thank you very much. My guests have been Paul Carroll, who is a new U.S. nuclear policy expert with Plowshares Fund, and K.J. Metcalf. And, K.J., I didn't get a title for you. What's your position, or concerned citizen? Or
concerned citizen is a great one, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat.
When all my faith had worn away, with no heart left to make love stay, you found the door I closed within and opened it again. I don't know what lies beyond or what will
Tracy Spring will be performing at the Rookery at 7 o'clock. That was Tracy Spring singing for us. It's 3:35 here at KTOO in Juneau. I'm Pat Moore. I'm guest hosting the Juneau Afternoon program today. And my two guests in the studio right now are involved with a low vision support group. On the show, we talked with some SAIL folks. These folks are also involved with SAIL. My guests are Janet Lumiansky and Dale Wiegand. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us.
Yeah. So tell me about the low vision support group. This is one of the adaptive programs that the other ladies were talking
about. That's right. SAIL, it's really nice to be able to segue into talking about a particular program when after Jordan and Kate were here. So I'm Janet, and what I do at SAIL is coordinate the center. We have an aging and disability resource center. So anyone who has concerns or issues or needs of resources can call us at SAIL and talk to either me or one of my coworkers about getting resource information about their disability. And one of the disabilities or issues that we work with is low vision. And, you know, many of us, we're sitting in a room with three people, and three of us have glasses. So the definition of this particular program of low vision is if you have glasses or contact lenses that have been prescribed for you, and it doesn't bring your vision back to 20/20, then you're actually considered a low vision person. So there, since you can no longer get glasses or get another pair of glasses, another prescription that will increase your visibility, the visibility, then there are many adaptive devices that can be used. And that's one of the things that we offer at SAIL. I was just asking Dale, actually. He has been in the low vision support group for quite a long time. And so he can tell you more of the history about, you know, things that they've done as part of the support group. And then I can tell more of the adaptive equipment that we have for folks.
So, Dale, would you be comfortable telling us what kinds of adaptive devices you use?
That I use?
Uh-huh.
I have a magnifying glass that they're, like, hooked onto a pair of glasses. So by getting real close, I can read the computer or the newspaper or whatever. And it leaves my hands free to type or whatever I'm doing or hold the reading material. I use that, and I use a little binocular.
Oh, what?
A little monocular.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and to see things like prices in the grocery store that are too high to read or street signs or things like that. And then I have a little hand lens, actually, that I carry around for prices on the grocery store, the meat or whatever, to read whatever it is. So those are the three things I use most of all.
Mm-hmm. What other kinds of adaptive devices are there in your catalog, I guess?
Well, we have at SAIL, one of the services that we offer, again, is a loan closet. And in that loan closet, I mean, we have everything from wheelchairs to walkers and canes. Canes are some things that people might need to use if they have low vision. And then we have a whole array of low vision assistive devices, from the magnifiers that Dale's talking about, that have LED lights that are handheld, to stand magnifiers, to computer screen magnifiers, binoculars, high-powered glasses. People can buy over-the-counter reading glasses, but they only go up to a certain power.
Mm-hmm.
And as eye diseases often progress, people have a need for a higher power of glass, of lens. And Dale, I'm thinking that you might have you met with a low vision therapist when she's been in Juneau before?
Yes, I have. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I wanted to let folks know about. There's actually there's a woman by the name of Deborah Guiley who works at the Alaska Center for the Blind in Anchorage, and she is coming to Juneau in November. I don't have a date yet, but at the end of this, I'll make sure that you have we have a phone number we can give folks.
Okay.
And what Deborah does is she's a low vision therapist, and she's also a mobility a person who can
help people with their mobility issues. So as a low vision therapist, she will meet with folks individually for an hour, up to an hour. She'll look at their last vision exam, and then she will help them by offering specific adaptive devices for their sight issues. And she also, out of the Alaska Center for the Blind, she has a grant that she works with that can offer each person up to $100 to buy a device that they might need, because they get pretty spendy. And what I see people using most are the handheld magnifiers that, you know, help illuminate letters and things. So she'll be here in November, and we'll be taking names and phone numbers. People can call me at SALE, and I'll be talking to them individually about what they need to bring to the meeting when she comes. So I don't have a date for her yet.
Is she here for a couple of days?
Yeah, she'll be here, and she's great. She will she'll kind of adapt her schedule to the number of people who want to be seen. So she'll make the time.
So
she's
if someone's
really
interested in working with Deborah, they need to contact you.
They can contact
well
me
in advance, so we can give her an idea of how many people.
Yeah, and also they'll need to bring their last vision exam with them, or with them, so that she can look at their eyesight issues specifically and help them figure out what they need. Because again, low vision is, you've already got the glasses, you know, we've got our glasses, mine are recent prescription, and I'm still, you know, I still need some special things to help me see better. And so we meet on the last Tuesday of every month, the low vision support group.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Dale, you said you had worked with Deborah?
Yeah, I saw her about a year ago, year and a half ago.
Can you describe the process that the two of you went through? Do you remember?
Well, she mainly just asked you what you're interested in and what kind of visual impairment that you do have, because or whether you're interested in seeing better on the computer or distance vision or close-up reading or whatever, because there's a whole range of different devices that she has and can show you and that you can try out.
And then after you worked with some of those devices and like that, did she help you get those, or is it SALE who helps you or?
Yeah, she helped. She'll put in the order, help you get it ordered. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back to this money for the expensive kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Who's eligible to ask for those grants?
Good question. Actually, anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that Deborah serves. So that's what she has explained to me, that anyone she sees is eligible for those grants.
So it isn't a matter of income level.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Because some of this stuff, I think, can get pretty pricey.
Some of the stuff is very pricey, and you know, and it is $100 worth of items that she can help you with. And I've been looking at some things for folks, you know, to help with computers and to help them do continue to do their beadwork or their carving or, you know, whatever their interest is. And yeah, they can get up into the thousands. There's some good things on there for your permanent fund.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that one of the biggest problems that would stop someone from doing this would be a kind of a sense of embarrassment, perhaps, mm-hmm. at making contact. So if someone has that problem, is there a way for them to privately come to you? I mean, this is not a public process. You can walk in and talk to someone without having it all be in front of the support group.
Right. Thank you for asking that question. That's absolutely right. The support group exists for people who want to participate. We just had today is the last Tuesday of the month. We just had our meeting, and one of the things that we did, well, we did a couple of things today. One of the things we did was several people brought devices that they had ordered on their own to show other people. And so everybody tried those out. Another thing we did today was there was some interest in talking to the regional manager of the Department of Transportation to talk about signals at crosswalks and how we'd like to lengthen the amount of time that's given for a person to walk across the street, especially people with visual impairment or people who might have a disability of some kind or another. So we wrote a letter, collective letter today. So we do a variety of things at the Low Vision Support Group, and that meets on the last Tuesday of every month at the Mountain View Senior Center in the dining room, and that's usually from 1 to 2.
So 1 to 2 at the Senior Center on the last Tuesday of each month.
Right. And we'd love to have more people come to that, and hopefully Dale will give a little bit of a history of that. And but the other thing I do want to say to answer your question is absolutely, if people are not comfortable coming to a group and talking with a group, they can call me directly. We can meet in our office at SAIL. I can go to their home with an array of visual devices that they can try out at their comfort.
So, Dale, can you tell us some of the history of the support group?
The group in the past has taken quite a few trips. We went to Sitka, and we also went to Skagway. Another year we went to Whitehorse. Another year to Atland. This is like for 3 or 4 days in the Orca caravan. And everybody enjoyed it, but we haven't taken any trips recently.
Yeah. Orca is the adaptive sports program that we talked about earlier that SAIL operates, and they evidently have a van that you can use for these trips.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we also have a senior. That was the other thing. We have a Orca and a SOAR program, SOAR, Senior Outdoor Activities and Recreation.
Oh.
And we try to do things, especially during the summer. But I'm much newer to this than Dale is, and so he's been regaling me about trips that they've taken in the past. And
do you think he's hinting at something?
I'm hoping.
Yeah.
It'll be fun, especially to see the fall colors.
Mm-hmm.
But the opportunity for people who, you know, might not feel comfortable because they have low vision going on a trail, but having somebody there with them, you know, that can guide them. So that's another opportunity that we offer.
Dale, I understand that you play accordion. Is that
rumor
true?
Yeah, I've been playing accordion a long time. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, somebody told me that it would be appropriate to end our interview with some accordion music, so I think we'll probably be doing that in a couple of seconds. So I wanted to run over the dates and times again. Deborah Guiley will be coming to Juneau in November.
Yep.
And so between now and then, you would like people who would like to work with this low vision specialist to contact SAIL and just ask for the low vision support group?
Mm-hmm. Or they can ask for me, Janet.
Okay.
And I'll take down the information.
Okay, Janet Lumiansky. Mm-hmm. And they will need to bring to that session, they'll need their last vision exam results.
Right.
So it's important to make sure that they can get access to those. And then the Dale, the dates and times on the support group, again, are...
It's the last Tuesday of each month at 1 o'clock at the Mountain View Senior Center.
Magnificent. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming in and telling us about this program.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for the time. Thank you.
about 10 minutes to 4 in the afternoon. You're listening to KTOO-FM.
This is Bird Note. Teddy Roosevelt said of America that no other nation on earth has been blessed with so great a wealth of natural bounty, and in our care of nature, we become worthy of this gift. In that spirit, in 1908, Roosevelt established the Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuge, the nation's first for waterfowl. Benefiting today from Roosevelt's foresight are cinnamon teal. For them, the refuge is an important breeding area. The male teal is gorgeous, with bright coppery breeding plumage and scarlet-red eyes. The female builds her nest near water and conceals it completely. She comes and goes through tunnels in the vegetation. Extremely agile in flight, cinnamon teal are one of the least abundant dabbling ducks in North America. Their future is tied with the availability and quality of water and wetlands in the arid West. The Lower Klamath Refuge lies between mountain ranges in northeastern California and southern Oregon. Fall and winter bring hundreds of bald eagles and huge flocks of tundra swans and snow geese, all beneficiaries of our providing a place for birds to thrive. Today's show brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
I'm Pat Moore. I'm the guest host for Juno Afternoon. It's about 8 minutes to two or to four right now. And I have with me in the studio Renee Drummond, who's a teacher at the Juno Community Charter School. And she's here with two students from Juno Community Charter, James Turner and Honesty Zahn. Did I say your last name right, Honesty?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And these folks are here to tell us about an upcoming trip that they're going to take to Denali, which and to Fairbanks, as I understand it. Renee, why does the charter school have this trip coming up?
Well, last year was the first year that the charter school had an eighth grade, and kind of within the creation of that, we recognized that the students, especially of that year, had kind of been in the same classroom since kindergarten, first and second grade, and then they were going to be moving on to the big high schools, and so we felt it was appropriate for them to take a trip. And through some time and conversation, we decided that Denali was the place that we'd like to go. And then we worked on fundraising throughout the year and ended up going last May with that eighth grade group.
And now you're going to do it again.
Yeah, I think we're hoping that it becomes kind of a school tradition that the eighth graders work throughout the year fundraising and then take a trip up to Denali.
Now, James said that he's never been to Denali, but Honesty said he had. So, Honesty, how come you went? With your family? Or?
Yeah, with my family. We went over the summer.
And what did you see?
We saw a lot of animals, including 16 bears and 36 caribou, which was very cool.
You know, most people who go in on the park road come back and they say, we saw a bear. 16?
Yeah.
Do you have some kind of method for attracting bears?
No.
Trail garbage behind your car. So, and now you're going to go back with the trip? So
yeah.
You'll be kind of like the tour guide, is that right?
I suppose.
You'll probably stand up in the front of the bus and say, and to our left we see our first of the 16 bears we'll be seeing on the trip. And James, you've never been. Is that right?
No, I've never been to Denali.
Have you been up north to Fairbanks? Or?
Yes, actually I have.
Uh-huh. And so this will be kind of a homecoming when you get back to Fairbanks, right, when you go on the trip?
A little bit, yeah.
Have you been on a school trip before?
On a school trip, yes, I have.
Where?
I've been probably, I can't remember, but because it was down in Washington before.
Oh, okay. So you came up to Alaska from Washington?
Yes.
Yeah, you were in school there. So you guys are in the charter school.
Yes.
That's, mm-hmm. That's kind of different from the like going to one of the other schools in town. Do you like it?
Actually, quite fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. What makes it so fun?
Mostly the people there are actually quite nice.
Very nice, yes.
How big is your class?
Our class is 32 people.
32 people? And you know most of them?
Yes, most of them I knew.
Yeah. Do you hang out after school?
Some I actually do hang out with.
I see the charter school walking back and forth through downtown Juneau quite a bit. Is that this group or is that a different part of it, Renee?
It would be all the students at some point. We go to the park by the Capitol School, and so we walk over there. But also being located downtown, we can go to museums easily, the library, Marine Park, down to the harbor. So the location does allow us to walk to many places throughout town.
So with a small class size, you can do that kind of activity and like that?
Absolutely, and with parent support, which we much appreciate.
I'm aware of the fact that the charter school is fabulously wealthy, so you don't have to raise right. any money for this event at all, right? You're just going to take it right out of your pockets.
Oh, no. The kids did a lot of fundraising last year, and for the most part, they raised 100% of all the funds for the trip. And we're getting started earlier this year and trying to plan ahead to make sure that the funds are there for the trip this year as well.
Okay. And what are you looking for people to do in response to your fundraising? What kind of events are you planning?
Sure. So one that we have this coming weekend, October 1st, there's the community garage sale at Centennial Hall. And mm-hmm. so we're going to have a booth there.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's okay for me to give a phone number.
Oh, sure.
We're hoping if anyone's willing to donate things to be sold, that they don't mind the profits being used for the 8th grade trip. There's Beth Rivest is the parent who is helping with the fundraising or running the fundraising, really, and her number is 723-0612. So if anyone had an item that they wouldn't mind us getting the proceeds from. And then we'll also be selling cards that were created from the photography of students in the past couple of years. And then there's a couple other events that we have. Another one, October 29th, we want to have a carnival. It'll be at the Juneau Community Charter School building in the Arcticor building on 5th and Gold. And there'll be face painting and mini golf and crafts and things like that for probably kids under 12. It'll be staffed by middle schoolers, so it'll be geared more towards younger children.
Wonderful. Well, these events will be announced as they come up, and there will probably be a lot of people around. Do you have a website where people can find out more about this?
You know, we do have the charter school itself has a website, and these events are posted on the website there as well. So if you went to the Juneau School District and then found the charter school, you could get information about those events through that website.
Okay, James, if you could see one animal up in Denali, what would it be?
Probably a caribou or a bear.
Ah, a caribou or a bear. And honestly, what do you want to go back and see? 16 more bears?
Lynx or a wolf.
Wow. So you didn't see those on your first trip up.
Well, I saw two wolves.
Thank you very, very much, folks. We're a little cramped for time here, but thank you for coming down and telling us about this event.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Are you considering other educational options for your student? Then consider HomeBridge, a program that builds the link between school and home by allowing up to 2 classes at local high schools with no allotment reduction and makes sports, theater, and other activities possible within the Juneau School District. HomeBridge offers parents a direct educational connection with their K to 12th grader. HomeBridge, Juneau's hometown homeschool, 209 Home.
And that's all the time we have today for Juneau Afternoon. Tomorrow on Juneau Afternoon, Jeff will be talking with the folks who are producing Birth, sponsored by the International Caesarean Awareness Network, and Bruce Simpson will be coming on to talk about this week's Messiah Community
ORG.
Sing Fest.
The increase in premiums we see this year is not primarily a result of
health reform.
So why have family health insurance premiums jumped by 9% this year?
It's Tuesday, September 27th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Coming up, a new study examines the rising cost of insurance premiums.
The study also found that more adult children are getting coverage under their parents' insurance plans, as mandated by the new law.
Also, many retirees are finding that retirement isn't all that it was supposed to be.
I'm ready to retire. Retirement's not ready for me. I mean, I have to keep working just to survive financially.
In Greece, the public faces more taxes as the country tries to avoid default.
And should death row inmates in Texas be allowed to request a last meal?
Those stories coming up. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Testimony is now underway in the trial of Michael Jackson's personal physician, Dr. Conrad Murray. The first part of the day was dominated by the prosecution. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports then it was the defense's turn.
After hearing prosecutors describe Dr. Murray as a doctor who treated Jackson only to keep the monthly retainer of $150,000, it was lead defense attorney Ed Chernoff's turn. The Houston lawyer told the jury that his client established a practice in that city's poorest neighborhood, one that had a dearth of medical services, and promised to introduce them to patients who would confirm greed wasn't Dr. Murray's motive.
Ruby Mosley and other patients will tell you that when they came to see Dr. Murray, nobody asked how you were going to pay. If you couldn't pay, Dr. Murray wouldn't charge you.
After that, two witnesses were called. Choreographer director Kenny Ortega and an executive for AEG Live, the group that was to produce Jackson's comeback concerts. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
A high school in Denver, Colorado was the backdrop today as President Obama renewed his call for Congress to pass his jobs bill. NPR Scott Horsley reports the measure includes billions of dollars for school renovation.
President Obama says the science lab here at Denver's Abraham Lincoln High School dates from the 1960s and is badly in need of updating. That's the kind of project he says could be paid for with money from the American Jobs Act. He's pushing lawmakers to approve.
And that won't just create a better learning environment for students. It'll create good jobs for local construction workers right here in Denver and all across Colorado and all across the country.
The Jobs Act also includes bigger payroll tax cuts for workers and businesses next year, with the cost to be offset by higher taxes on the wealthy. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Denver.
Closely watched Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Housing Price Index shows prices in July posting a fourth straight month of gains. Prices in 17 of the 20 cities tracked by the index were up from the previous month. Biggest percentage gains in monthly home prices were in Detroit, Chicago, and Minneapolis. Prices fell in two cities that were among the hardest hit by the housing crisis, Las Vegas and Phoenix. In just the latest sign, Americans remain pessimistic about the overall direction of the U.S. economy. A key consumer confidence index barely budged this month. Business research group The Conference Board says its confidence index was up just 2/10 of a point. Scott Brown, an economist at Raymond James & Associates, says one reason is that much